at his perceived length and girth, then refocused her attention on seduction.
"Are you surprised that I'm ready?"
she whispered in a half-teasing, half-come-hither voice, her breaths growing shallow with need. There was nothing pretend about it. He smiled, but he didn't answer, and God give her strength, but when he removed his shirt, exposing that divine, rock-hard chest, she felt every nerve ending in her body come alive. When he toggled his thumb over the top button of his jeans, sliding the clasp out of the seam, she almost quivered with fear and excitement. There was no way she could accommodate that thickness, let alone withstand his immortal power. She was not his true destiny, after all, and heaven forbid, what if he instinctively figured it out, realized that she didn't have a womb, somehow felt her hollow center. She gulped. "Not now, Kyla. Keep him focused on having an orgasm. You can do this. He will not try to get you pregnant. He hasn't converted you yet, and he won't be thinking anything, if you do your job right. He knows you're still human. He knows that he has to be careful." She reached for the vampire and shut her eyes. 20. Saxon Olaru had used his mind to do a lot of things in the past, and as a vampire, he had a unique and intimate relationship with blood. But he had never used his mind to pump blood into his lower region before, to force a functional erection. Great celestial deities, what was wrong with them? On one hand, he had everything he'd ever wanted right in his arms, right beneath him in his bed, the female he had waited several lifetimes to claim. On the other hand, something wasn't right. Not with him, not with this blood moon, and not with his mind, heart, or soul. That voice, that name, Kiera. It wouldn't let him go. Just the same, he had only one chance to get this right. Any of it, all of it. There was no do-over button. He couldn't just rewind his actions or his decisions. If he hurt his destiny deeply, if he betrayed her fragile trust, if he invaded her mind or her memories, investigated her like a criminal, those actions might haunt him forever. And eternity was a very long time to live with someone whose heart he had broken, or to live in a home built on secrets and lies. As it stood, the facts were still the facts. Kyla had the markings of Lord Cetus on her inner wrist, however odd they may have first appeared. She had been within reach at the emergence of the Cetus blood moon, just as divinity promised, and humans were not aware of the curse or its meaning. Hell, they weren't even capable of seeing the phenomenon in the sky, unless they were the chosen of the gods. Kyla had described that crimson moon with awe, and her dreams. All her life, she'd had those dreams about Saxon. She'd recognized his soul. At this juncture, Saxon was looking forward to Saturday night's reception. Marquise already knew the deal. Nakari the wizard would be there, and Saxon could ask his brothers for their counsel, their opinions, their much-needed feedback. He could ask them to watch Kyla closely, to watch the two of them together. If everything was still a convoluted mess after that, he would take his concerns to Napoleon. He had no other choice. Something was definitely up, and it wasn't the part of him that should be, at least not organically. Blanketing her body with his, he took her breast into his mouth and played wicked games with his tongue and his teeth, until she began to writhe beneath him. He slid his hand down her waist, making quick, playful work of removing her panties, and shimmying out of his own bulky jeans and boxers, and then he blanketed her again. Her eyes, those dark brown chestnut orbs, sought his with such carnal hunger that he almost gave in to the urge to take her. But something stayed his hand. As he thrust his hips toward her pelvis, he expertly rocked to the side, brushing against her thigh instead of entering her body, even as he penetrated her mind. He took hold of her sensory awareness. He embedded his thoughts in her mind, and he guided her, mentally, through a contrived short-term memory where the two of them were making love. Heat, passion, thrusting. Tasting, touching, exploring, their bodies coming together in bliss. Saxon took Kyla to the peak of arousal and sent her over the edge, even as he threw back his head, feigned his own release, and collapsed on top of her damp, quivering body, grateful that the deception had come to an end. Only, great celestial gods in the heavens, he felt like crap for doing it, for making her believe they had just shared such intimacy and passion. But something inside of him, nothing within him, would allow him to see it through. He was not capable of making love to his destiny, and that, above and beyond everything else, cemented the fact that something was very, very wrong. To Saxon's way of thinking, he would use the party on Saturday to seek the counsel of other vampires, and then, if needed, he would take his concerns to Napoleon. If, through all that, his brothers and his king saw nothing amiss, had no dire concerns of their own, then he would just put his doubts and his concerns to rest, and spend the rest of his life making it up to her. His immortal life depended on this mating. Was there any such thing as being too careful? Kyla wrapped her arms around his shoulders and sighed in post-coital bliss, and Saxon returned the sentiment with a devilish, ingratiating smile.
"Was that what you wanted, my love?"
Damn, he was a bastard, he thought. She licked her bottom lip and giggled.
"Yes," she breathed with satisfaction. "Only I may need to experience that again, and again, and again."
He chuckled in a deep, raspy growl.
"I aim to please, Angel."
He brushed her hair behind her ear and planted a soft, languorous kiss on her mouth.
"Mmm, you taste like heaven."
Son of a bitch. He was soulless. Kiera Sparrow rested her forearm over her eyes, trying to staunch her tears as she lay in bed that night, feeling like the world was closing in on her, like she was doomed no matter what. She had done everything her captors had asked of her. She had played her violin like her very life depended on the effort, taking inner solace only during those rare, grace-filled moments when she got lost in song from a secret garden. The rest of the time had been hell. She had showered and bathed when they allowed it, eaten their bland, lumpy food, and bent over backward to please, appease, and submit to Xavier Matista, just to show him that she wasn't a threat. And she had gambled everything, placed all her eggs in one volatile basket, on escaping Saturday night, shimmying out a five-story window despite her debilitating fear of heights. She wanted to live. She was much too young, and she was doing everything she could think of to survive. "Try to reach Saxon. Your bond is strong. He may be your only hope." Her tears began to drench her forearm, and she had to choke back her sobs. She had tried so many times that night, like a lost, blithering fool she had tried. She had visualized a blank canvas, trying to conjure an image of her words in dark, bold caps. She had led the exercise with deep breathing, trying to achieve some elusive, metaphysical state of being. She had repeated the refrain like a mantra, hoping to send it into the ether with sound. And she had pictured a single golden cord extending from her third eye, she didn't even know what that was, to Saxon's, some fairy tale mythical vampire, as she sent her plea through the line. "Saxon, can you hear me? It's Kiera. I need help. I'm being held captive in a five-story warehouse by vampire hunters, and I think you're my only hope." Nothing. No reply, no sensations, no vision or intuition. Nothing but silence answered back. And now, as she thought about those words, that celestial cosmic force she had encountered in the bathroom, what little hope she'd had slipped away. If Saxon was her only hope, then were her plans to escape doomed to fail? Her sobs grew more desperate, and she knew she couldn't contain them any longer. The pain, the fear, the horror, the angst. She rolled over onto her stomach, burrowed her face in the pillow, and wept like her body might come apart.
"Saxon, it's Kiera. Why can't you hear me?"
21. Saturday morning, 10 o'clock. Braden Bratiano stood on the main level of the four-story brownstone and reached behind the large leather sectional to hang the last dangling piece of the golden Welcome Home banner. He took a few steps back and eyed the shiny letters to make sure they were centered with the rally coffee table. Glancing up at the 14-foot ceiling, he snickered at the myriad of gold, silver, and ivory balloons, a few of them gravitating randomly toward the contemporary Asian clock above the fireplace mantel. Then he eyed the elegant, mobile, black and stainless steel bar that Nakari had erected for the occasion, stocked with vintage expensive spirits. A broad smile curved along his lips. Whereas humans catered their parties with cake, finger foods, and punch, it appeared vampires outfitted their get-togethers with Blue Label Scotch, 1800 Chateaus, and decadent French cognacs, all arranged next to priceless crystal decanters, Waterford glasses, and sleek paper-thin flutes. He could only hope Nakari would allow him to sample the spirits. Reaching into the back pocket of his pressed black jeans, he retrieved his cell phone and reread the text from his mother. She had sent him a message just before boarding the House of Jaden's private plane on a remote tarmac in Hawaii. "I'm so very excited to see you, son. Can't wait to get there. Save lots of hugs and kisses for myself, Dario, and Conrad. Love you, Mom." He scrunched up his face and closed the screen. He could save lots of hugs and kisses for his mom. That seemed pretty normal. But for Dario and Conrad? He was no longer 15 years old, and that just wasn't manly. He absently wondered what Conrad looked like. His little brother would be 12 years old now. He had to have shot up by several inches, and more than likely he still had Dario's dirty blonde hair and gunmetal eyes, the peepers a few shades darker than his father's pale grays, and a skinny but muscular frame. Braden had to admit he was anxious to see him. He was anxious to see them all. More than that, he was eager to introduce them to Christina, his intended. He laughed at the sound of those words. It was what it was. On top of that, he had a special gift custom-made for the redhead, a glossy 5x7 card with the words, "Thank you for always having my back," embossed on the front, and "Passion, death, and foreboding are not quite as frightening with you here to help me breathe," engraved in the interior. The card was attached to a velvet-lined box that contained a gorgeous friendship bracelet, a sleek platinum band attached to a thin platinum chain, peppered with onyx and rubies, gemstones he had made by himself. Well, with the help of a few ancient warriors at the Dark Moon mineral plant. But why split hairs on the details? Christina would love the bracelet. She would probably get along with his parents, at least if she could forgive them for their perceived neglect, and they would definitely adore Christina. Who knew? Maybe by the end of the night, all would be right with the world. Kiera Sparrow shuffled to the door of her bedroom, correction, her captor's bedroom, and stared at the bronze oil-rubbed knob, deciding whether to open it. She had just taken a shower, donned a pair of Owen's gray sweats, a plain Hanes t-shirt, and a pair of men's gray socks, and she felt revived enough, desperate enough, to contemplate a short encounter. On one hand, she was starving. Owen hadn't brought her any dinner last night, and he sure as hell hadn't brought her any breakfast. She would need all her strength to punch out that window, remove the loosened bolts, and shimmy down the side of the building. But on the other hand, did she really want to bother Owen Green, give him a reason, any reason, to torment her further? She sighed and backed away from the door, trying to gather her courage. "Damn it, Kiera," she told herself. "You can't go a day and a half without eating. Besides, he isn't going to touch you. At least, he won't physically assault you. Xavier won't let him. It's forbidden." She could only hope that the frightening headhunter's directives were still being followed. She took a few steps forward, gently palmed the doorknob, and silently twisted it to the right until she felt the latch slip free. Owen no longer locked it during the day, at least not all the time. Apparently he figured there was nowhere she could go, and she pushed it a couple inches open. Pressing her forehead to the frame, she peered out into the open floor plan, and stifled a gasp. Owen was standing in the middle of the warehouse apartment next to Travis, They had moved the sofa to the side of one wall, and they were outfitting a stainless steel table in its place, in the center of the freaking living room. It looked like something one might find in an industrial kitchen, or worse, in a morgue. In the top two corners, they had attached two lengths of chain with loops on the ends, connected to handcuffs. And toward the bottom, they had installed two leather straps, the perfect size to clasp ankles. Beside the morbid table was a plain wooden stand, and what sat atop the platform made Kiera stagger sideways. An ancient clay basin with a blood-red cross dyed into the stone, a crude serrated dagger with something inscribed in the crossguard, she couldn't read it from the bedroom, and a sacramental bowl filled with plain clear liquid. Could it possibly be holy water? Next to a box of latex gloves. Oh, hell no. Kiera yanked the door shut and spun on her heels to run. She couldn't wait until nightfall. Whatever they were planning for their macabre party, she had a sickening feeling in the pit of her stomach. She was the guest of honor. A pair of heavy footfalls stomped across the warehouse, and Kiera's heart seized in her chest, her feet frozen in place, as Owen Green threw the bedroom door open and stormed into the room. He must have seen her through the alcove. "Get your violin," he barked. "We need some music while we decorate." Kiera gulped. She eyed the distance between herself and Owen, trying to remember what was on the other side of the door, a marble-topped pedestal table with a heavy brass statue atop, the figurine of a hunter. She could tuck the violin beneath her left arm, leave the bow dangling in her left fingers, and snatch the statue with her free right hand, then swing it like a baseball bat at Owen's skull. She would have to drop the violin, who cared, and keep right on swinging the statue over and over, until there was nothing but brain and blood and tissue left. But then there was the problem of Travis. He was standing next to the table with the wicked-looking dagger on top, and he would doubtlessly come to Owen's defense. Still, the tuning fork could be used as a stiletto, but how hard would she have to thrust it to impale a grown man's breastplate? Before she could conjure up a better plan, Owen reached into the waistband of his pants and retrieved a .45 caliber handgun. He pointed it right at her, and his light green eyes grew murky. "I've had enough of the princess violinist act, and Xavier's not here to save you." He smirked, and the visage was pure evil. "Don't get me wrong. I would never disobey my headhunter. But the thing of it is, Miss Sparrow, I finally have his permission." His pointy tongue snaked across his lower lip, making his features appear demonic. "Xavier's done with you, sweet princess. He's finally had his fill, and that means we can do whatever we want." He glanced over his shoulder at the stainless steel table and rubbed the barrel of the gun against his groin. Was he crazy? "Oh, and we want. But not just me, all of us. Believe me, we intend to take turns." He laughed then, as if anything he had just said was funny. "But luckily for you, it's not yet time. You have a few more hours to wait." His sex jerked in his pants, and Kiera felt like she might throw up. "Until then, you're gonna play that fiddle. And by fiddle, I mean just that. None of that stuck-up Bach and Beethoven shit. We want to hear something more unique. In fact, why don't you try your hand at 'The Devil Went Down to Georgia'? Think you can pull that off?" He raised the barrel of the gun, pointed it at her head, then her heart, then her gut. "Something tells me you're gonna try. Real hard." He cackled at the double entendre in the last two gravelly words. Real hard. They were planning to rape her. All of them. The entire vampire-hunting group. And then they were going to torture her. God only knew how, and kill her. And Xavier was not going to stop them. Kiera had run out of time. As her knees began to buckle beneath her, she struggled to catch her balance. "No, don't fall. Don't pass out. Don't give up." She still had half a day to think. It was only 10:30 a.m. She needed to take this opportunity to survey the warehouse, categorize everything she could use as a weapon, figure out how to barricade the bathroom door. She needed to pour every ounce of energy, intelligence, and will into fashioning a plan that could work at a moment's notice, then wait for that moment to arrive. At some point, Owen had to feed her, or at least allow her to relieve her bladder. Something or someone would distract him, if only for a second, and Kiera needed to be ready. Straightening her legs and stiffening her spine, she slowly spun on her heel and headed toward the cursed violin case. Yes, she could play The Devil Went Down to Georgia, or The Devil Went Down to Denver, as it were, and she could blend into the background while the animals schemed and planned. And all the while, she'd be plotting as well. 22. 8 o'clock p.m.
Marquise, this is Kyla. Kyla, this is Marquise. He's an ancient master warrior, revered in the House of Jaden.
Kyla listened carefully to each of Saxon's introductions, wanting desperately to impress each vampire she met, or at the least, not to set off any warning flags. And holy hell, was this dude ever intimidating. With thick, long black hair and eyes so black they gleamed phantom blue, like the bottomless depths of the ocean, his rock-hard shoulders and enormous commanding frame were only eclipsed by his stare. The vampire could snap someone's neck like a pencil with the mere rotation of his wrist, and he looked like he wouldn't hesitate to do so. Kyla cleared her throat and extended her hand, willing it not to shake.
Nice to meet you, Marquise.
He didn't take her hand. He simply nodded his head, once, in an arrogant dip of his chin, and continued to stare right through her. Kyla gulped, and Saxon placed a reassuring hand on the small of her back.
Don't let him rattle you, he said, chuckling. Marquise is not all that social.
Kyla forced a confident grin and breathed a sigh of relief as a raven-haired beauty with stunning golden eyes sauntered to Marquise's side. Her bearing was positively regal.
Is Marquise growling at the guests?
She asked, in an amused, lyrical tone. She brushed her thumb along the warrior's chiseled jaw in an absent, tactile greeting, and Kyla read a thousand messages in that simple, unobtrusive gesture. Deep, abiding love, hot, smoldering passion, and unconcealed reverence. This couple clearly adored each other in every way imaginable.
I'm Kyla,
she blurted, feeling as clumsy as she sounded. The beautiful female pretended not to notice. She extended her elegant hand, taking Kyla's.
Siopori Demir Silavasi,
she said with the confidence of a monarch.
Princess Siopori, Marquise corrected, with a barely audible growl in his throat.
Kyla nodded in quick acknowledgement.
So nice to meet you, Princess Siopori. I take it this warrior is yours?
Marquise sneered, but Siopori tossed her head back and laughed.
His bark is worse than his bite,
she whispered, turning to eye him directly.
Marquise, behave.
The corners of his fearsome mouth turned up, and Kyla immediately got it. This woman held his heart in her hands, hell, her little pinky, and as long as one was respectful of Siopori, one was probably safe from Marquise.
That's a lovely dress,
Siopori added, glancing at Kyla's blood-red ensemble. The lacy flowing skirt fell to mid-thigh, the silk strapless camisole fit her like a glove, and Kyla was immediately grateful that Saxon had picked it out yesterday, assuring her it was appropriate for the party.
Thank you,
she said sincerely, opening her mouth to comment on Siopori's majestic black party dress. She quickly pursed her lips together. There was nothing she could say. The dress fit the princess like a second skin, the low V in the front exposing her perfect assets, the hip-hugging sequined panel riding her thighs like a lover, the exquisite material accentuating her flawless figure. The woman was beauty personified.
You look amazing,
Kyla said, feeling like an ugly duckling by comparison. Marquise's powerful arm snaked around Siopori's waist, and he tugged her beneath his shoulder. All righty then, Kyla thought, shifting nervously in place, despite the fact that she and Saxon had made love 3 times since Thursday night. There was no such amorous love play between them, and she suddenly felt bereft. Squaring her jaw, she stiffened. It really didn't matter.
She wasn't there to find her happily ever after. She was there to complete a mission. Having met Jocelyn and Nathaniel, Nakari and Deanna, Kagan and Ariel, and now Marquise and Siapuri, Kyla knew one thing for certain. This high-level list of targets was simply and unequivocally off-limits. She could not get the best of any of them. Jocelyn was wily. She was nice, but always watching. Nathaniel was deaf with blue-black hair and a deceptively seductive smile. Nakari was like a floating crystal ball. Despite those stunning green eyes and ungodly good looks, unless Kyla wanted him to read her soul and extract it with nothing more than an arrogant flick of his pinky, she needed to stay clear of Nakari. Deanna was probably okay, but it would be a mistake to underestimate her, especially when it came to her son Sebastian. As for Kagan and Ariel, talk about awaking a sleeping giant. The couple was the most dangerous of all. Kagan's demeanor was so laid back and relaxed. He was so welcoming and unassuming. But underneath that placid veneer, there was a reservoir of something just swirling. And Ariel, she was more cautious, almost demure. But that, too, could be deceiving. Kyla had lived long enough and hung out with enough rowdy characters to know a street fighter when she saw one. That woman could kick some ass if she had to. That left the Sentinels, Santos, Ramsey, and Saber, and Braden and Christina, Dario, Lily, and Conrad, and the only two children who were there, Sebastian because he lived there, and Nikolai Jaden because Marquise and Siapuri couldn't find a babysitter. Kyla slipped her hand inside Saxon's for comfort, and wasn't that just ironic, considering the nature of what she was thinking? Nevertheless, she couldn't help it. His brothers were too intimidating. Ramsey, well, there was something just not right with the male. He was all hard lines and rugged edges. He reminded Kyla of a gentle pit bull circling around the company, all cute and well-leashed until he locked onto someone's leg and snapped their tibia like a chicken wing. He hadn't brought his destiny Tiffany. Apparently she was with the king and queen. And that was just fine with Kyla. The last thing she needed was to try to deceive the most powerful living vampire on the planet. As for Santos and Saber, they were also flying solo. According to Saxon, it was because they were officially on duty. And Santos, Saxon's older brother, well, he was a lot more cerebral by nature. Kyla couldn't lie. He was handsome and sexy as hell, with that unusual mixture of black and blonde hair. But he looked like the wheels were always turning, like he was the smartest guy in the valley, and he knew it. According to Saxon, Santos was a guru with electronics, so maybe that explained it. Just the same, Santos had a savage edge hidden behind those crystal blue eyes, and he watched Kyla and Saxon like a hawk. Both he and Ramsey did, and it was more than a little unsettling. As for Saber Alexiaris, Kyla shivered at the thought. The vampire was the closest thing to a dark one she had ever encountered. They had learned all about the House of Jaeger from the Vampire Hunting Society, but she had never stood within an arm's reach of someone who had called the dark community his home. Between Saber's red and black locks, a smile that was really a scowl, and that characteristic swagger that screamed, "I don't give a shit," and "I'd just as soon drain you as look at you," Kyla had no intentions of going after Saber Alexiaris. Besides, he wasn't on the list. She had already narrowed her focus onto two potential victims, Sebastian Silavasi and Nikolai Jaden. The former would turn a year old in a week. The latter would be 2 years old in September, which made him 17 months old now. Their parents couldn't help but brag. Absently glancing at the contemporary Asian clock above the mantel, Kyla made note of the time. It was already a quarter till nine, and that mattered for one very important reason. Kitaro Silavasi would be showing up to the party around 10 o'clock, and once he was there, all bets were off. There was no way Kyla was getting near those kids with the patriarch of the family hovering. As it stood, Sebastian was in his mother's arms, but Nikolai was sleeping soundly in an upper-floor bedroom, in one of Sebastian's cribs. Kyla had her cell phone back, a gesture of trust and goodwill from Saxon. and now all she needed to do was slip away under the guise of using the restroom, remove her 5-inch stiletto heel, which could double as a stake, and find that coveted infant. Then she could slip out through the 4th-story terrace, duck into the forest, and call Owen or Travis for an extraction. All she needed to do. Hell, she may as well have been trying to scale Mount Everest. She knew Santos and Saber were on the rooftop terrace, and Ramsey was stationed outside the front door. Just the same, she was determined to live. She had no intention of dying in this lavish brownstone, surrounded by predatory creatures.
Kyla? Kyla? Where are you, sweetheart?
Saxon's voice interrupted her musings, and she almost flinched. Thank God, Moses, and every Catholic saint she couldn't think of that the House of Jaden operated by a severe code of honor. So far, no one was reading her thoughts.
I'm sorry, she muttered nervously.
Where were you?
Saxon repeated. She made a whimsical gesture with her fingers.
I was lost in thought, I guess.
She batted her eyelashes at him and squeezed his warm, reassuring palm.
I'd like you to meet our hosts and the guests of honor, he said, angling his chin toward 5 approaching vampires.
Kyla already knew 2 of them, just from Owen's texts. Braden Bratianu and Christina Riley Silavasi, a redhead carrying a fluted wine glass. She assumed the other 3 were Braden's parents and his brother.
Kyla, this is Braden.
Saxon gestured toward a gorgeous 6-foot-tall male with hypnotic burnt sienna eyes.
What's up? Braden said.
Kyla immediately smiled.
What's up?
She replied in a slightly less casual tone.
And this is his future mate, Christina.
The redhead rolled her eyes.
Lay off all that future mate crap,
she clipped, her satirical attitude preceding her.
I'm just Christina. Nice to meet you, Kyla.
She held out her free, slender hand with immaculately painted nails, and a stunning bracelet dangled from her wrist.
One thing you need to know up front. The testosterone levels in the House of Jaden are off the charts, but the women rule the roost. So don't hesitate to let these guys know it, or they'll walk all over you.
She winked, and her bright blue eyes practically sparkled with mischief. Kyla laughed.
I'll have to keep that in mind.
And then she turned her attention to the next hand extended toward her, that of a tall, attractive female with hair the same color as Braden's and soft, greenish-brown eyes.
Hello, Kyla. I'm Lily Bratianu, Braden's mother.
Her voice was gentle and nurturing, and she immediately turned toward Braden, grasped both of his cheeks between her thumbs and forefingers, and gave them a motherly pinch.
Can you believe how handsome he is? She bragged. And he's gotten so tall.
She blushed and shook her head.
I know you didn't know him before, but it's just so unbelievable. He's just so incredibly handsome. And tall. My baby is all grown up.
Mom, Braden whined, looking utterly embarrassed as he grasped her wrists and gently lowered them.
Stop. She doesn't know me. She doesn't care.
Lily scrunched up her brow.
How could anyone in this valley not know you, or not care?
This time she cupped his cheeks in her palms and simply gazed at him lovingly before brushing an imaginary piece of lint off his shoulder, no doubt as an excuse to touch him. She turned toward Kyla a second time.
Is he not the most handsome thing you have ever seen? Honestly, tell me the truth.
Christina almost spit out her drink and Braden shut his eyes.
Mom, seriously, stop. Ahem.
A tall, imposing male with dirty blonde hair and pale gray eyes cleared his throat and stepped forward, his left hand resting on the shoulder of a kid maybe 12 or 13 years old.
I'm Dario, the handsome thing's father, and this is his brother, Conrad.
The kid looked up and smiled, and he was the spitting image of his sire. He had the same dirty blonde hair, only he wore it in neatly groomed spikes, and his eyes were a much darker gray.
Hi,
he said casually. Kyla waved her hand.
Nice to meet you, Conrad.
She turned her attention back to Dario.
And nice to meet you, too.
And then she smiled for all she was worth at Lily.
And yes, your son is a devastatingly handsome young man.
It was true. Braden rubbed his brow and Christina laughed, causing her bracelet to clink against her glass. In the background, Siapori whispered something to Marquise, something about checking on Nikolai, and Kyla saw her chance.
You know what?
She spoke in a whisper.
I think the drink I had earlier went right through me.
She sheepishly shrugged her shoulder.
Maybe it's a human thing.
She glanced at Siapori and smiled.
I don't mind checking on your little one. I absolutely love kids. Either way, I'm afraid I need to excuse myself for a moment.
Siapori glanced at Marquise, then Saxon, each of the warriors in turn.
Are you sure?
She asked Kyla.
Oh, absolutely,
Kyla answered.
If someone would just point me in the right direction, to the bathroom and the baby, I'd be happy to peek in on his room.
She raised her eyebrows in question.
If he's awake, do you want me to bring him down?
Siapori hesitated, but only for a moment. She glanced at Kyla's inner left wrist, the markings of Saxon's constellation, and she immediately relaxed.
He should be sleeping soundly, but if he is awake, just come back and get me.
Kyla nodded graciously, and Braden Bratianu chimed in. Take the staircase at the end of the hall to the upper level. Last room on the left. The first door on the right is the bathroom.
Thank you,
Kyla said warmly. She could feel Siapori's gaze on her back as she walked away. And then Lily, ever the proud mother, redirected the conversation.
Has my son told you about his gorgeous jewel? What a thoughtful gesture it was.
She was obviously referring to the ruby and onyx bling dangling from Christina's narrow wrist, and her voice radiated warmth.
Christina, tell everyone about Braden's gift.
She lowered her voice to a whisper, but the words could still be heard.
Of course, you can leave out whatever the secret is.
She must have addressed the group as a whole because she coyly added,
Apparently it has some special private meaning, but she can tell us about the stones. How Braden made them himself at the mineral plant.
Kyla heard Christina laugh, and she immediately tuned her out. Time was of the essence, and Kyla needed to be smart, swift, and focused. In and out of the bathroom to turn on some running water. These vampires could all hear like bats. Then on to Nikolai's crib, tiptoeing all the way. Everything she had learned, every sacrifice she had ever made, every grueling hour of preparation was now coming into play. Kyla would not disappoint her colleagues. She would make Xavier Matista proud.
23.
Put your violin away, Kiera, then change into your robe.
Owen's heartless command snaked through Kiera's veins like ice water flowing through an old rusted pipe, making the vessel contract and groan. As her throat constricted, she stared at Travis Landon, standing at the edge of the living room holding out the robe. So they expected her to change right there, in public, in front of everyone. She gulped, turned her back on Owen, and padded slowly toward the violin case. The guests had arrived promptly at 8, a short, skinny, bald kid who Owen called John, two dark-haired muscleheads who looked like brothers. Travis had greeted them as Mike and Nick, and a short, robust woman who dressed like a biker chick. The others referred to her as Rachel. 4 new guests, plus Owen and Travis. Xavier was nowhere in sight. As the vampire hunters had entered the warehouse, Kiera had played her violin while Owen dimmed all the lights. Travis had followed behind him, lighting a stream of garish black candles, and carrying a bowl of putrid-smelling incense. And then the guests had changed their clothes, donning insane-looking dark-hooded robes. It had been like a scene from a horror novel. The room had been cold, the air had been electric, and the hum of Kiera's violin, playing one fiddling song after another, had grated like fingernails on a chalkboard, scratchy, discordant, and ominous. And now they just expected her to go along with this gruesome, insane, godless sacrifice. Well, they would see about that. Kiera tucked the violin away in its case, retrieved the tuning fork in the palm of her hand, and then slowly stood up and began to shuffle backward, heading toward the bedroom door, pretending to be too frightened to obey. She didn't have to pretend. Stop! Owen barked. Then he nodded at Travis, and as expected, Travis strolled forward with the white terrycloth robe brandished in his tattooed right hand. The blood-red eyes of a boa constrictor tattooed around his neck seemed to stare right at her as the asshole approached. Kiera sidestepped toward the decorative pedestal table and the statue of a hunter resting on top. She bowed her head in submission, and her muscles began to twitch in barely concealed anticipation. Travis grinned, flashed his smoke-stained teeth in a parody of a smile, and his greasy hair fell forward into his eyes. Then he grunted and thrust the robe in her direction.
"Take off your clothes and put it on," he ordered, licking his bottom lip.
Kiera almost hurled. She inched the tuning fork further down between her fingers, prongs facing out, and slowly stepped toward him. As she reached for the robe with an extended left hand, she gouged him in the stomach with her right, directly below his ribcage. She drove her full weight into the thrust, then forced the fork inward and upward. Travis gasped in shock, but she didn't wait for his reaction. She let go of the fork, twisted toward the table, and grabbed the statue in both hands. Then she brought it down over his head like a baseball bat, her body whirling off balance from the force of the swing. Travis crumpled to the ground, and she tripped over his falling body, sprawling onto the floor. Her socks could not gain purchase on the smooth wooden planks, so she crawled toward the bedroom on her knees.
"You bitch!"
she heard Owen bellow from the living room as he scrambled into action. Kiera's heart sank to her stomach, and her breath hitched in her throat.
"Oh God, oh God, oh God," she panted, clambering to get back on her feet.
She reached down to her ankles, first the left, then the right, and yanked the socks off, flinging them away. Her toes dug into the wood, gaining traction, and she rose to her full height, like a sprinter coming out of the blocks. She didn't bother to look behind her. She knew Owen was close on her heels. Rather, she sprang through the bedroom door, slammed it behind her, and scurried to the nearby armoire. Slamming her body against the side of the dresser, she grimaced as a jolt of pain shot through her shoulders. Nevertheless, she yanked and she pulled until the tall, heavy piece of furniture toppled over. Owen slammed his shoulder into the bedroom door just as the armoire blocked his passage. Thank God. The door was blocked, and there was no way they were coming through that alcove, not with all those iron inserts. She sprinted into the adjacent bathroom, spun around, and locked the door. Once again, they weren't getting through the alcove windows. She opened the top drawer of the nearest vanity, removed a length of violin E-strings, the thinnest of the bunch, and clutched them in her fist. Earlier that week, she had laced the strings together and hidden them inside the drawer. She had also removed two medium-sized nails from behind two pieces of artwork and pounded them into the doorframe, one on the left and one on the right, about 6 inches above the tile floor. Dropping to her knees, she twisted the ends of the strings around the nails, looping them as tight as she could while drawing the trip line taut. With any luck, Owen would break down the door or use tools to remove the lock, something that would eat up time. And when he dashed into the bathroom, he would trip over the cord and bust his head on the vanity. She could only hope. Her lungs burning as if they were on fire, she dashed to the linen closet, retrieved the rope made of sheets, and shot through the open Tuscan shower, beyond the jetted bathtub, to the single-pane window. Her hands shook like she was afflicted with a neurological disorder as she fumbled with the latch, slid the window open, and punched out the screen. Tears of desperation fell like rivers down her cheeks as she tied the sheet around the window frame, frantic to secure it tightly. God help her if the sheet came loose. Finally, once the sheet was secure, she took a deep, ragged breath for courage, climbed into the windowsill, and turned around to start scaling the building. And then she froze in place. The 5-story cement-gray warehouse was covered with slick vertical siding, and that meant there was a 50-foot drop down to the waiting pavement. Kiera's throat constricted, and her palms began to sweat. She couldn't do this. There was just no way. She heard Owen and what sounded like a few other guests slam the bedroom door against the armoire, and the heavy piece of furniture scratched the floor as it slid slowly out of the way, making a terrible grating noise. And that pushed Kiera past her fear. Briefly closing her eyes to whisper a prayer, she fastened both fists over the first bulging knot and slid out the window, her bare toes immediately seeking the first knot beneath her. She felt the protruding lump against the arch of her feet and hooked both ankles around it, pressing her knees together for stability. And then she shimmied downward like a caterpillar, searching for the next handhold and the next protruding lump. Panting or hyperventilating, it was all a matter of perspective. Kiera inched her way down into the cold, damp night, undaunted by the elements, the wind swirling up behind her, the soft fall of rain beginning to pelt her shoulders, the faint stench of garbage rising up from the alley beneath her.
"Don't look down," she told herself, as she took one section of the rope at a time,
one knot after the other. Her arms burned. Her thighs began to tremble. She wasn't in shape for this climbing.
"Stop it, Kiera. Just keep going. Keep moving. You've got to get to the ground."
Xavier Matista receded into the shadows of the alley, trying to keep the rain off his skin. He had promised his trite human followers a victim, a ceremony, an opportunity to blow off some steam, and he had delivered Kiera Sparrow on a silver platter. However, by the looks of it, the humans couldn't even get that right. He growled deep in his throat as he thought about the whole demented setup. The vampire hunting society was useful to the Lycans. The humans could go where werewolves could not. However, they were so simple-minded and irrational. While Owen had been a competent leader of the Metropolitan Cell, and Travis had made a good lackey, they were so obsessed with mounting their captive they couldn't see the forest for the trees. Hell, even Rachel, the deranged biker chick who was still rebelling against society for rejecting her as a teenager, was chomping at the bit. At the age of 35, just to watch the other males take Kiera. Xavier had wanted no part in the ritual, and not because he gave a rat's ass about Kiera, about the destiny of an immortal vampire. He had chosen to abstain because he thought it was a waste. The woman had an exceptional talent, and also, if and when he needed to slake his masculine urges, he had his own plaything tied up in his Earthrealm apartment. No, Kiera Sparrow, that was all about business. He had enough vials of blood, enough tissue samples, and enough containers of urine to take back to Mir, turn over to the Lycans, and allow greater scientific minds to do the research. His goal was to murder Saxon Olaru, strike a blow for the Lycan kind for a change. His goal was to use Kiera's sister to strike back at Kitaro Silivasi's clan, and she was right on the verge of doing it. Just the same, he had been unable to resist standing out in the alley, listening to Kiera play the violin one last time with his superior supernatural hearing, scenting the brutal sex play, or sniffing the perfume of death, knowing all the while that it was finished. Saxon's last breath was intrinsically linked to Kiera's, and Xavier had made it happen. Watching now as the determined human female shimmied down a rain-soaked string of bedsheets, he chuckled. Damn, she had really tried. Oh well. Arching his back and stretching his neck, he began to shift into his Lycos form. While razor-sharp teeth and a savage canine muzzle protruded from his collapsing skull, he grew to his primordial 10-foot height, reveling in the raw, unchallenged power that enveloped him. And then he bounded into the alley and loped toward Kiera. 24. Siapori Demir Silivasi replayed the short conversation in her mind.
"I don't mind checking on your little one. I absolutely love kids,"
Kyla Sparrow had said.
"Either way, I'm afraid I need to excuse myself for a moment." "Are you sure?"
Siapori had asked.
"Oh, absolutely,"
Kyla had answered.
"If someone would just point me in the right direction, to the bathroom and the baby, I'd be happy to peek in on his room."
Siapori had pushed gently into Marquise's mind on a private telepathic bandwidth.
"Warrior, what say you?"
she had asked. Before Marquise could answer, Kyla had raised her brows.
"If he's awake, do you want me to bring him down?"
Siapori had hesitated, but only for a moment, taking the opportunity to glance at Kyla's inner left wrist, the markings of Lord Cetus that branded the female as Saxon's mate. Prior to the party and with a bit of prodding, Marquise had shared the purpose of Saxon's pre-dawn visit on Wednesday morning, and Siapori had found it all so terribly sad,
The fact that warriors could no longer trust their blood moons. The fact that Saxon was grappling with so much angst. But this was altogether different. This was about Nikolai, their son. She had smiled warmly at Kyla and answered in a motherly tone.
He should be sleeping soundly, but if he is awake, just come back and get me.
She'd quickly nudged Marquise again.
Warrior, what does Saxon think?
The ancient master warrior's psychic voice had been firm and resolute.
My love, don't be alarmed. The sentinel is already tracking her heartbeats. He is intimately aware of her position in time and space. I don't know if he's just being cautious or if he fears she might try to escape their fate. But I believe it should take the average human female about 4.5 minutes to use the facilities. 5.5 minutes if she messes with her hair and makeup. And it should take another 2 to 3 minutes to look in on Nikolai. Anything beyond that, and I will follow up.
As Brayden Bratianu gave Kyla directions, Siapori fought the urge to frown. After all, it was a private conversation.
No disrespect, warrior,
she had said.
But how in the heck did you come up with those numbers?
Marquise didn't hesitate to frown.
Are you making fun of me, my love?
Never, my handsome gladiator,
she'd quipped. He'd harumphed in her mind.
I took an aggregate of the last 10 times you and Vanya have excused yourselves to the bathroom, considered what I knew you were doing in there, and calculated an average. Then I added some time based on a human's slower responses.
At this, Siapori nearly chuckled, and then grimaced.
I'm not even going to ask why you are monitoring both myself and Vanya in the restroom. I don't even want to know.
She paused to let her censure sink in.
But I will defer to your calculations, as I know you are quite precise. However, if Saxon's destiny takes longer than 8.5 minutes, I will follow up instead of you. You are far too high-strung, and she is Saxon's destiny. There's no need to frighten the girl half to death. I just want to be cautious.
Marquise leveled a sideways glance at his mate, then nodded his head reluctantly.
Thank you,
Kyla said to Brayden, and Siapori watched as the female walked away. Kyla Sparrow darted into the upstairs bathroom, just long enough to turn on the water and allow it to run in the sink. If Saxon was listening from afar, he would just assume she was bashful and drowning out any noise in the presence of so many vampires. She removed her right spiked heel, detached the small rubber tip at the end of the spike, then slipped it back on her foot. Careful to open and close the door as noiselessly as she could, she tiptoed quickly to the last bedroom on the left and carefully tilted the knob until the door drifted open. Holding her breath, she peeked inside. If the little vampire was awake and playing, her plan would need to be aborted before it had begun. He wasn't awake. In fact, he was sleeping peacefully, like a little angel, tucked inside a light green blanket. How odd, Kyla thought. They treat these little monsters like real human children. Well, that was about to end. She crept softly toward the crib, eyeing the large mass of raven-black hair swirling around the infant's scalp in thick, gentle waves. With Marquise for a father and Siapori for a mother, Nikolai's hair could not have been anything other than gorgeous raven-black. For a moment, she wondered about the color of his eyes, but she quickly steeled her resolve and refocused her attention on the task at hand. Bracing her left hand on the top bar of the crib, she bent her right knee and twisted her body to remove the unstrapped red heel. She took a deep breath in an effort to slow her breathing, reached slowly into the crib, and drew back the light green covering. The vampire was wearing a onesie, but it shouldn't be a problem. Kyla had sharpened the point of the already razor-thin heel at Saxon's estate earlier that morning, before covering the tip with the smooth rubber plug. Unless she had worn it down by walking, it would cut right through the fabric, flesh, and muscle, assuming she applied enough pressure. She would only get one chance. Moving so slowly, so quietly, that her motion was barely detectable, she bent over the babe and lined the edge of the heel right over his little heart. His chest rose and fell with a loud exhaled breath, and she froze, waiting to see if the feather-like pressure on his chest had woken him up. Nothing. He wiggled his nose and fell back asleep.
Kyla sighed in relief. Child or not, this was still a vampire. She had no idea what the toddler could do with his claws or his fangs, how loud he could scream or hiss. Placing the heels of both hands over the heel of the shoe, she locked her elbows in place for greater penetration and leaned forward into the thrust. 25. Kiera Sparrow shook her head rapidly from side to side, trying to extricate her rain-soaked bangs from her eyes. She couldn't release the rope in order to clear her vision, yet she was terrified of descending any further with her sight compromised. The rain was icy cold. It had already soaked through her t-shirt, and her feet were growing numb. She needed to feel every inch of the sheet, and every protruding knot, in order to grasp the surface firmly. Not to mention, her sweatpants were growing way too heavy. As it stood, she was quaking like a leaf, trying to support all 125 pounds of her 5'8" frame. She didn't know if she could hold on if her body grew any heavier.
"Don't think like that, Kiera," she whispered to herself,
glancing up at the shadowy moonlight.
"You can do this. You have to do this. You're already halfway there."
Despite her previous resolution, her determination not to look down, she glanced beneath her freezing toes toward the pavement, hoping to be encouraged. But what she saw seized her heart, stole her breath, and rocked her all the way to her bones. There was a giant beast with a wild mane of deep golden-brown hair beneath her. He was coated in thick, wiry fur, and his mammoth jaw jutted forward, flashing a mouthful of vicious teeth. The wolf was positively enormous. His muscles rippled as he stalked up the building, scaling it like a spider, as if he were climbing an unseen web, naturally, effortlessly, and with terrifying ease of efficiency. Kiera's eyes met the creature's, and she froze in place. His demonic eyes were adorned with pale amber irises and rimmed in a circle of black. Xavier Matista. The werewolf from her dream. The nightmare from her waking reality. He was everything he had claimed, all her subconscious had sensed, and he was crawling up the building to kill her. She screamed and let go of the rope. Her heart plunged in her chest, as if gravity was yanking it out of her body, and her arms flailed at her sides as she pitched through the air, plummeting toward her death. The lichen slammed up against her, wrapped a steel corded arm around her waist, and continued to scale the building as if nothing had interrupted his climb. He snarled against her ear, and she felt a wet, sticky trail of saliva trickling down her neck. Kiera thought she would die right then and there. Not from Xavier's canines, and not from the harrowing fall. The 28-year-old violinist was certain she would die of fright. What happened next was so seamless and surreal, she wasn't even sure it had happened. Xavier, the wolf, arched his back and rolled his spine as Xavier, the man, crashed through the warehouse window, landed on the bathroom floor, and shoved Kiera forward, toward her waiting captors. In an instant he was gone, and Kiera was facing Owen alone, a vindictive, rage-filled human who was blinking like he'd just seen a ghost. Kiera instantly got it. These stupid, clueless vampire hunters had no idea that werewolves existed, and Xavier intended to keep it that way. Owen had probably seen a blur, and he was too dim-witted and brainwashed to question the laws of physics. For all he knew, Kiera had given in to a fear of heights or been overcome by the frigid rain and climbed back up the rope on her own. Yeah, because that would have ever happened. She shook her head in both terror and defeat as Owen lunged forward, fisted her by the hair, and began to drag her backward across the travertine floor. "Travis is on his way to the hospital. Rachel is taking him," he snarled. "So it's just you, me, John, Mike, and Nick." He kicked what was left of the trip rope out of his way, and by the uneven dotting of blood on the floor beneath the curled E-strings, Kiera knew that the snare had worked. At least temporarily. The next words Owen spoke pumped ice into Kiera's veins, and she wished with all her might that the werewolf would have killed her. "I'm going to carve you up into creative musical pieces. Then I'm going to slit that divine celestial wrist and watch you bleed out while John, Mike, and Nick take you,
all three of them at the same time, and when they're finally finished, you will still be alive, but barely. Do you know why? He bent over to press his nose against hers, and his breath was rancid. Because I want the last thing you see in this lifetime to be my eyes. I want you to watch them roll back as I mount you. He cackled like a fiend. Think of it this way. I get to come, and you get to expire, all in musical harmony. And that, Princess Kiera, is the only destiny that awaits you.
Wait, stop. What did you just say?
Saxon asked Christina, who continued to wax poetic about her beautiful new bracelet, a gorgeous platinum band dotted with onyx and rubies. Christina wrinkled her nose.
What part?
She asked innocently, failing to pick up on the sentinel's concern.
About the onyx and the rubies, or how they symbolize a two-toned rose?
The two-toned rose, Saxon clarified. Elaborate on that.
Christina turned toward Brayden, her eyebrows raised in question, and the two of them exchanged a knowing glance. Finally, Brayden gestured toward the bracelet and shrugged.
Go ahead, he said casually. Just leave out the private part.
Christina smiled, angled her body back toward Saxon's, and mimicked Brayden's shrug.
Okay, let's see, she mused. Well, as Brayden more or less indicated, we shared a personal moment, something that had to do with a crimson and black rose.
She shifted her weight from foot to foot, rocking on her 6-inch heels.
Anyhow, he made this bracelet for me as a symbol of that moment, kind of a thank you for helping him out.
Saxon frowned, his pulse beginning to throb in his temples. They weren't getting anywhere with this line of questioning. He decided to be more direct.
Not good enough, Christina.
He spoke in a firm, no-nonsense tone. Then, turning to regard Brayden directly, he added,
I'm sorry, son. I don't mean to pry into your private business, but this might be significant. In fact, very important. I need you to tell me everything there is to know about that bracelet and the black and red rose.
Having overheard Saxon's statement, Nakari Silavasi sauntered up to the circle of vampires and stood next to Brayden.
Son, he interjected. This might be the breakthrough we were waiting for. The significance you couldn't quite intuit. Tell the Sentinel everything.
Brayden visibly paled.
Oh, shit, he said apologetically.
Oh shit, what?
Santos Olaru chimed in, appearing at Saxon's side as if out of nowhere. Ramsey was right on Santos's heels, crowding the growing circle with his tense, overbearing energy.
Ah, damn. Brayden repeated. I didn't think... I mean, we were paying attention, but we were never sure. We were monitoring the visions to see what happened next. I'm sorry, Saxon.
What visions?
Ramsey snarled, his model-fine features growing harsh.
Shh,